I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 161 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week, Bruce Spicer, has written a lot about the Beatles, including all the notes inside the new vinyl box, the Beatles' U.S. 1964 albums in mono. This new all-analog from the original master's offering from Capitol and Apple Corps is kind of a companion piece to the 2014 acclaimed and much-coveted The Beatles in Mono Box, which collected the original British mono releases of the Beatles albums up through the White Album and assorted later singles. The Beatles' U.S. 1964 albums in mono includes the American versions of the band's early albums, Meet the Beatles instead of With the Beatles, followed by the Beatles' second album, The A Hard Day's Night soundtrack, Something New, which duplicates 5 songs from The A Hard Day's Night soundtrack and 8 songs from the British Hard Day's Night album, The Beatles' Story, which is basically a double album documentary without songs, The Beatles' 65, which did come out in 1964, and The Early Beatles, which actually came out in 1965 and contains songs from 1963 and 1962. Every album but The Beatles Story is also available to buy separately. Inside each one is a 2-page spread featuring Spicer's liner notes as he explains how these chopped-up U.S. Capitol albums came to be. A key figure is Capitol's then-head of foreign product, Dave Dexter, a man who turned down the Beatles 4 times before he was finally put in charge of releasing their music in the U.S. While the British label Parlophone would release the singles separate from the albums, Dexter included the singles on the U.S. releases. So Meet the Beatles kicks off with I Wanna Hold Your Hand instead of It Won't Be Long from With the Beatles. The American albums also are shorter, with 12 and then 11 songs on each compared to the standard 14 for the British ones. Yet if you lived in the U.S. up until the British versions became standard with the 1987 CD releases, these are the albums you knew. And there are differences, not only in how they're sequenced, but how they sound. Spicer is happy to explain. In his day job, Spicer is a tax and estate planning lawyer and CPA in New Orleans. That expertise has helped him untangle the Beatles' complex early dealings with a variety of labels, including Chicago's VJ, which had the Beatles' U.S. rights when Capitol first passed. Spicer has written many Beatles books, including The Beatles Records on VJ, The Beatles Are Coming, The Birth of Beatlemania in America, and ones dedicated to the U.S. Beatles albums. Here, Spicer digs into the odd way that the Beatles broke into the American market, the instrument that convinced Dexter that Love Me Do and Please Please Me weren't commercial, how Not Even She Loves You was a hit when released on the Swan label, and the role that British singer Frank Ifield somehow played in all of this. Then came the twists of fate that resulted in I Wanna Hold Your Hand taking off, the rush release of Meet the Beatles, and the band's world-changing performance on The Ed Sullivan Show. Spicer also discusses the music itself, how the U.S. album configurations and mixes were sometimes more exciting than their U.K. counterpoints. What was different about And I Love Her, I Feel Fine, and many others? If you know me, you know I love talking about the Beatles almost as much as listening to them. You can hear that Spicer feels the same way. I didn't think it was possible, but I came away with an even deeper appreciation of what the Beatles achieved over one incredible calendar year. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Bruce Spicer. Where are you, by the way?
I'm in New Orleans.
That's what I thought. I was reading your bio stuff, and it sounded like you'd been at Tulane and stayed there. And
yeah, I grew up in New Orleans. I've lived here my entire life.
Nice. I've had a few New Orleans guests, most recently Susan Cousel. So,
oh yeah, Susan's great.
Yeah, Leo Nascentelli, another one.
Oh yeah,
Ivan Neville. Art. New Orleans is a great city and a great music city. So I need to get back there at some point soon. And you're an estate lawyer down there.
Yes.
Like you tax an estate lawyer.
Yes.
So is collecting Beatles albums a good form of estate planning?
Well, it could be. I mean, some of those things have gone up in value. I think the main thing was the training that I had as a lawyer and as a CPA really helped when I went to write books on the Beatles.
How come?
Well, for one thing, research. In other words, as an attorney, you need to know how to research. And I prepare a book the same way I prepare for trial. And as an attorney, we go through what we call discovery. That's where you review documents and you interview potential witnesses. And then as an attorney, you have to write it up in a way someone will understand it. It's the same thing with a book. You research it, and you write it up in a way someone will understand it. You want to make it an attractive presentation. And judges give you deadlines, and so do printers.
Yeah, and so, in both cases, you have to tell a story also.
Yes, so it works well that. And then also my CPA background helped me because it made it easy for me to read complex royalty statements and financial statements and all these other things. So the legal and financial training I had was a big asset. Plus, I love the music.
Right. Yeah. You've worked on a lot of Beatles projects. Did you set out to make that a specialty, or did it just sort of your fandom and your skill set sort of intersect at some point?
It intersected at some point in a weird way. I was working on a class action lawsuit involving retirement plans and got a really nice check after 4 years of hard work. And I noticed, and this would happen mainly in New Orleans, that roaches had eaten the spines of all of my Beatle albums except Meet the Beatles, which they left alone.
Wow.
And they left the band and all these other groups alone. It was very strange. And so I wanted to replace those albums with the original pressings from the 60s. And when I was doing that and reading up about the early VJ releases, what I was reading didn't make any sense to me. And I talked to record collectors and dealers, and they go, "Oh, no, that's in every book. It's right." And being a lawyer, I thought, well, what if every book's wrong? So I did some original research, realizing VJ and Capitol must have sued each other. I found four lawsuits from 1964 in Chicago, LA, and New York, had those records copied. And from that formed a lot of the basis of the first book that I did, the Beatles records on VJ.
Now, when I was a kid in the 70s, I bought Introducing the Beatles, and everyone was like, it's a bootleg. You know, you get it at Walgreens or whatever, and it was a bootleg. Like, all of those copies, I guess, that came out in the 70s were supposedly bootlegs. Like, where did those come from?
One of the former officers of VJ had a lot of the pressing parts and the artwork, and he put those out on the West Coast. And then on the East Coast, let's just say some organizations you might not have wanted to get involved with put some of those out. But as what I tell people is that Introducing the Beatles, if you could count sales of counterfeit copies, it would probably be quadruple platinum.
Wow. Yeah, I know. It seemed like it was all over the place. And honestly, with this 1964 US mono box, set that just came out. It's a beautiful box, beautiful package, excellent liner notes from you.
Oh, thank you.
And very, very nicely annotated. You know, your sort of double truck is inside of each one of those records, and you pull it out and you read along as you're listening to the record, which is kind of reminds me of when I used to get records in the first place, and you'd read along with whatever it was in there, as opposed to having this big book that's, you have to sort of pull out the book every time with some of these other collections. So it's fun. How do you look at these records? Like, are these sort of, this is just the way that most people heard the music at that point? I mean, the American market was bigger than the British market. I mean, a lot of us have defaulted to the British ones because, the CDs all came out on those, and we also think they're better because there are more songs on them, even though the American ones actually put the singles on the records.
Yeah. But
where does this all fit now? Like, is this an exercise in nostalgia for people who, just remember it a certain way? Or is this actually like, no, this is the way that even moving forward, it makes sense to experience the Beatles?
I think certainly it's, nostalgia, obviously. But also, I think to understand how Beatlemania happened in America, I think you need to understand how Americans were exposed to the music.
Sure.
And I do think that Meet the Beatles and the Beatles' second album is just an incredible 1-2 punch. Look, there's nothing wrong with the album with the Beatles. But if you were sitting at the Capitol Tower back in late 63 and you wanted to introduce a band to America that was virtually unknown, then I can't think of a better way to do it. And look, it is, as I say in my liner notes, it sounds really crass and horrible that Capitol would take these perfect albums and, and do things to them. But bear in mind that we were not in a global community in those days. Each country marketed music to its own inhabitants the way it best saw fit. And so, Japan had a totally different lineup for their Meet the Beatles. And, it was just the same way in every country. And not only that, but it wasn't just Capitol. It was all record labels did that. And it was such a fine art that even in the case of the Rolling Stones, their manager, Andrew Luke Oldham, had a different set of albums, and he was the one putting them together for the US and British markets. So, you know, it was just how it was done. And the other thing that I do when one of these people who just says, it's horrible they did that, how could they do that? I say, look, if you were going to introduce the group, the Beatles, to somebody who hadn't heard them before, what song would you rather have on that album? I Want to Hold Your Hand or Devil in Her Heart?
Right.
You know, so.
And which would you rather kick off the album with, I Want to Hold Your Hand or It Won't Be Long, which is a great song, but it's
Yeah, I mean, they're all great. And that's the nice thing about it. You know, the Beatles' music was so good that it would have been hard for Capitol to screw up. But when you look at what Dave Dexter did, okay, the philosophy was hit singles make hit albums. Why was that important? Back in those days in the 60s, before the Beatles, if a teen-oriented album sold 250,000 units, that was considered an incredible success. Capitol's original sales forecast for Meet the Beatles was 250,000 units. And here they were, in less than 2 months, they had sold 3.6 million. So yes, it was very effective.
Yeah,
so you put the hit singles on those albums. And he didn't change the running order of With the Beatles. He just, you know, rather than saying he butchered the album, he surgically removed the rock and roll cover versions, which he didn't think Americans would be interested in. You know, why would an American want to hear the Beatles, a British group, do Roll Over Beethoven when we could hear Chuck Berry's version? Why would we want the Beatles to do Please Mr. Postman when we had the Marvelettes? Well, Dexter soon realized Americans did want that.
Right. I was going to say he changed his mind given Beatles' second album had all the stuff he
absolutely
took left off.
He learned because Capitol of Canada did a single with Roll Over Beethoven, Please Mr. Postman, that was imported into the U.S. to the tune of about 350,000 units, and they were selling. So Dexter, you know, Dexter learned. He never became a Beatles fan, but he certainly understood what would sell.
All right, so Dave Dexter Jr. Is sort of a, because I keep seeing it as Jr., I guess, but he's sort of a, he's kind of a key figure in this box and in the Beatles U.S. history, because famously, he rejected the Beatles four times when EMI in Britain was saying, hey, you know, Capitol is our, you know, you're the American arm. You should put this stuff out. And he said no. And that's how introducing the Beatles ended up on VJ in the first place. So is he a villain in this story? Is he just sort of this ambiguous figure? Like, where do you put him after all you've learned about this?
Well, first of all, you need to understand Dave Dexter's background. He wasn't a hack by any means. He wrote for Downbeat magazine. He loved jazz. He produced Julia Lee, these great R&B records. He put together jazz collections for Capitol. So he was very good at what he did. What he wasn't good at was recognizing rock and roll music. He was in charge of the, you know, artist and repertoire for international recordings. When Capitol was bought out by EMI, Dexter was given that job. And he put together these wonderful albums of music from different countries and things. And his selections of singles, if you look at them, there's not a lot of rock and roll in there. And almost all of these singles sell in the, you know, some of them don't even sell 100 copies. Cliff Richard, who was humongous in the UK, he put out a Cliff Richard 45. It sold a couple of hundred copies. Helen Shapiro never sold big in the States. You know, and these were people that were selling big in the UK. And Dexter just, he didn't like rock and roll for one thing. And later he said the reason he didn't particularly like Love Me Do was it had harmonica on it. And harmonica was an R&B instrument that had no place in pop music or rock music.
Right.
Well, ironically enough, you know, Dexter, we'll go through it real quick. He turns down Love Me Do. No big deal. EMI didn't know what they had with the Beatles with Love Me Do. But with Please Please Me, George Martin and EMI began to realize they had something big. Dave Dexter turns down Please Please Me. It's got a harmonica on it. So that record's not just turned down by Dexter at Capitol. It's also turned down by Atlantic and all other, you know, majors. And there's an attorney named Paul Marshall in New York who represents EMI's U.S. subsidiary company called Transglobal. and he also represents Vijay. And in about, I guess it was about October of 62, Capitol Records turns down putting out Frank Ifield, who is humongous in the UK. And Dexter just, you know, he said, why, you know, I put out Cliff Richard, didn't sell. Why are we going to put out Frank Ifield? And nobody wants Frank Ifield. And Vijay Records at the time is trying to break into the white market. It is a gospel R&B label out of Chicago. And they put out stuff like Jimmy Reed, and that sells well. And EMI is leasing that from, you know, to put out in the UK. So that's where Transglobal steps in. So Vijay is, you know, got this working relationship with Paul Marshall. And Vijay puts out the Four Seasons. You know, it's a white group. And, you know, boom, Sherry's doing great. At the same time, they put out I Remember You by Frank Ifield, and it gets to number five on the charts. So Paul Marshall realizes, hey, nobody wants the Beatles. Maybe Vijay can do another Frank Ifield. So they put out Please Please Me, and it sells under 5,000 units. They put out From Me to You, and initially it doesn't do that well. The problem is there's a competing version out, and that competing version is by Del Shannon. So if you are a disc jockey in America and you see From Me to You by Del Shannon on the Big Top label, and you see on a gospel label From Me to You by the Beatles, well, you're going to go with Del Shannon, because in 1961, Del Shannon had a runaway hit called Runaway.
Right, of course.
With a great organ part. I still love that. But anyway, I digress quickly.
That song was ahead of its time, I think.
Oh, it was.
Like when you listen to that song, you don't think, oh, that's like way before the Beatles, but it was.
No, it's a fantastic song. So anyway, you can't blame disc jockeys for going with the Del Shannon one. But on the West Coast, the Beatles one does start selling well in August, and they have total sales of about 20,000 units on that. But at about that same time, that summer, Vijay, and you can't make this stuff up, is in financial difficulty because their president, Ewart Abner, had a gambling problem, and he took a couple of $100,000 of company money out to pay off his gambling debts. And because of that, Vijay did not have the money to pay royalties or to get records pressed or to get covers made or anything. And the company was in serious financial difficulty. This was all covered up because Vijay's owners really liked Ewart. They didn't want him to go to jail. They didn't want to embarrass him. He left and he started Dart Records. And Billboard talked about it like he left and there was nothing going on. But Paul Marshall, as the attorney for Vijay, knew what was really going on. And Vijay was not paying royalties on the Beatles or Frank Ifield. So Paul Marshall, and this was a real conflict of interest, but you know, if you're going to represent a company that's about to go bankrupt, or EMI, who are you going to take care of? EMI. So he essentially writes a letter on behalf of Transglobal, a telegram, telling Vijay to immediately stop production and distribution of all Beatles and Frank Ifield records. He actually was more concerned about Frank Ifield because he had the big hit with I Remember You.
Right.
Beatles hadn't done anything in the States. So now all of a sudden, you've got to find a record label for, you know, our group, the Beatles. And once again, Dave Dextry has the opportunity to put out the Beatles and Frank Ifield. He listens to I Remember You and She Loves You by the Beatles. And if you know those songs, She Loves You does not have harmonica, but I Remember You does. Well, Dexter incredibly passes on She Loves You and has Capitol put out I Remember You, which actually sells about 50,000 units. So it's by no means a bomb. And She Loves You ends up on Swan because their owner, Bernie Benek, had done deals with EMI for their Statesides label. As a matter of fact, the very first record on the Statesides label is Palisades Park by Freddie Cannon on the Swan label in the U.S. So She Loves You comes out on Swan, and even in Philadelphia, where Swan's based in, it doesn't get up to about 87 on the charts. Dick Clark plays it on American Bandstand. The kids look at the picture of the Beatles and they're laughing at their long hair. And on Raider Record, it gets a mediocre score. I guess kids didn't think it had a beat or you couldn't dance to it or something.
That seems so insane to me because She Loves You. I mean, Please Please Me is great also and was her first number one in Britain. But She Loves You is like one of the most all-time undeniable songs and hits ever, you know.
What are these kids in Philly thinking?
And if you put, and if you put, you know, She Loves You versus I Want to Hold Your Hand, I mean, it's not, I mean, I Want to Hold Your Hand obviously was the U.S. breakthrough that you're leading up to, but She Loves You, you know, you could say is the more explosive song, and the yeah, yeah, yeah is about as big a hook as you can have. And that's just, it's just sort of crazy to me that people actually heard it and heard that energy and they're like, eh, whatever.
Funny thing about it too, like in A Hard Day's Night at the Scala Theater concert, what do they end on? She Loves You.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's just such a great song. So anyway, She Loves You comes out on Swan, nothing spectacular happens. And what's interesting though is that VJ's original agreement was a licensing agreement for Please Please Me and Ask Me Why. But there was a rider added to that agreement by Paul Marshall when he had his VJ hat on. And essentially it said, this is a 5-year agreement and you've got to write a first refusal for all Beatle recordings during that 5-year period. So Sgt. Pepper could have been on VJ if things had happened differently.
You know, people talk about like, yeah, about how Decca, you know, famously passed on the Beatles, but it seems like VJ actually having the Beatles and defaulting on them is at least as big of a boo-boo.
Well, yeah, you know, it's a crazy situation, all right. So anyway, you know, we have a time we can talk about the lawsuits, but the main thing is VJ now doesn't have the Beatles anymore. Swan has She Loves You, nothing happens, and Swan's licensing agreement is much more narrow. It's 2 years, 45 format only, and they'll get the next Beatles 45 if they sell 50,000 units, which She Loves You does not do. If it sold 1,000 units, I would be shocked, initially, of course.
Right.
There is, however, one disc jockey, Dick the Derby Smith in WORC in Worcester, Massachusetts, and he likes this new Swan single, and he plays it on his station, and their surveys are requests only. And in mid-December of 63, before Beatlemania hits the States, She Loves You is number 10 on their survey. Hmm. You think, wow, that's really cool. Guess what was number one on that chart? You might be thinking, Dominique? Uh-uh. Number one was I'll Get You by the Beatles.
Really?
Flip side is She Loves You. Which shows you how
so the B-side was more popular.
Is. Yeah. But the point of it is the Beatles' music is so brilliant that even a B-side in a market that doesn't know who the Beatles are gets to number one on the charts. That's pretty impressive.
Right. So eventually, Capitol, thanks to the double dealing lawyer, they're able to sort of get back to, having the rights to this stuff somehow. Yeah. So what was the thing that finally got Dave Dexter to be like, okay, we should do this? Like what pushed him over the edge?
Yeah, Dexter claims that he made that decision on his own. And Megs Brown, who was a PR person who worked for Capitol on the East Coast, claims he was a big hero on it. I don't think that's correct. I interviewed Alan Livingston, who was the president of Capitol. And what Alan said was he got a phone call, you know, and it would have been in about mid to late November from Brian Epstein, which makes sense. If you're frustrated with a company, you call the president. So he says, Brian called him up and said, you know, I'm the personal manager of the Beatles. Why won't you release our records? And Livingston told him, well, you know, we've got this guy, Dave Dexter, who handles all of our international stuff. And in his judgment, it wouldn't be suitable for the American market. And Brian said, well, will you give them a listen and let me know what you think? So Alan Livingston gets on the intercom at the Capitol Tower and says, Dex, you know, let's talk about the Beatles. Bring me a couple of their records. And Dexter tells him, Alan, they're a bunch of long-haired kids. They're nothing. Forget it. And he says, look, just the same, I want to hear it. And he listens to I Want to Hold Your Hand, and he thinks there's something there. And so, funnily enough, he brings the record home to his wife, Nancy Olson, who's a famous actress. She was in Sunset Boulevard. She was in The Absent-Minded Professor. Wonderful lady. And he plays it for her, and she says, I want to hold your hand. Are you nuts? And he says, well, I think this could be big. So anyway, and that might have been one of the reasons why when Capitol did put out I Want to Hold Your Hand, they put I Saw Her Standing There on the B side because they wanted rockers on both sides. They were going to market the Beatles as the rocking Beatles. And so this boy was a ballad. And I think Livingston might have thought, well, my wife might be right. I Want to Hold Your Hand might not be. Let's get a rocker on the other side. So they chose I Saw Her Standing There, the opening track from the Please Please Me album to be the B-side in the U.S. In England, it was This Boy, you know, a brilliant ballad. We're now at the point where, you know, Capitol Records is going to put out this Beatles record, and it's going to come out in mid-January. So here's where fate lends a big, big, big hand. There are first few dominoes that have to fall. The first domino is a very innocent one, which I didn't really realize until, I'd say about a year ago, when I was kind of going over what caused Beatlemania to explode the way it did in America. The first domino was that on September 1, 1963, the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite expands from 15 minutes to 30 minutes. Why is that important? Now they have time for feature stories. The CBS Morning News with Mike Wallace had feature stories, but a smaller audience and a much smaller budget. So now the CBS Evening News can have feature stories. Why is that important? Because all kind of big things are happening with the Beatles in the UK, and the English, you know, the British branches of us, you know, CBS and NBC and ABC, the three networks in the US, their bureaus in London send film crews to see the Beatles in Bournemouth, England on November 15th. And NBC runs a story on the Huntley-Brinkley report, and CBS on the Morning News with Mike Wallace runs a story on the Beatles. And what my research 20 years ago uncovered was why nobody remembers that broadcast on CBS. And that's because a couple of hours after Mike Wallace broadcast that story on the Morning News, President Kennedy was assassinated.
Right.
It obviously did not run on the Evening News with Walter Cronkite that evening. So a couple of weeks later, Walter Cronkite thinks, you know, that story on the Beatles looks kind of fun. Maybe we could use something light to end the Evening News. And he puts it on the air on December 10th. And what's significant about it is two very important people see that broadcast. Actually, three very important people in addition to the other millions. One of them is Ed Sullivan. A month earlier, Ed Sullivan booked the Beatles to appear on his show twice, plus a tape show. And so all of a sudden, he's all excited. Why? Because the Beatles were on the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite for over 4 minutes. So the next day, he begins promoting the fact he's going to have the Beatles on his show in February. Also, the other important people is a 15-year-old girl named Marcia Albert from Silver Spring, Maryland. She writes a letter, there was no email in those days, to WWDC, her radio station, saying, I saw the Beatles, you know, on the CBS Evening News. Why can't we have music like that in America? By pure luck, the disc jockey involved, Carol James, who gets the letter, knows someone who is a stewardess, as they were called then, for BOAC, which later became British Airways. And he asked her to bring over the latest Beatles record. And so what she does is she brings him, I Want to Hold Your Hand. So he gets the letter, and a week later, on December 17th, he invites Marcia Albert to come to the station and introduce it on the air. And the recording was saved. And it's very cute. A very nervous Marcia Albert, her voice cracking, says, ladies and gentlemen, for the first time anywhere in the United States, here are the Beatles with I Want to Hold Your Hand. And they play the song. And after, he says, let us know what you think. Drop us a letter. And of course, what happens is, you know, the kids don't wait. They start calling the station. And it is like the old, you know, the cliche, the station switchboard lights up like the proverbial Christmas tree. And the next thing you know, WWDC is playing a record that Capitol had not wanted to put out until mid-January. So what does Capitol do? They get their lawyer, Walter Hofer, to call up WWDC and say, cease and desist playing that record. And basically they say, are you nuts? This is a hit. Put the record out. And Capitol realizes that's the case. They rush release the record, and it comes out the day after Christmas. Now, why is that so important? Think about it. Kids are out of school the day after Christmas. They're playing video games, right? Wrong. They're on their cell phones. Wrong. None of that existed. They're listening to the radio. WMCA jumps on the song, And about an hour later, WINS and WABC are playing it. So the three big stations in New York that kids listen to are playing this new song by the Beatles. Within a week, it's number one on WABC, and the rest of the nation follows suit. Why is that so important? Because if the Beatles record came out in mid-January, maybe it's a top 10 record at best before the Sullivan Show. But by the time the Beatles are on the Sullivan Show, this is a number one record. She Loves You's number two, and Please Please Me's on its coattails. And so by the time the Beatles are on the Sullivan Show, rather than the normal audience of 20 to 30 million people, 73 million people tune in. All of that happens because domino number one, CBS expands its evening news from 15 to 30 minutes.
Of all the musicians I've interviewed of a certain age, so many of them talk about that moment, you know, watching the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show as like the, I need to get a guitar, I need to write songs.
Yeah.
I mean, it was John, just, it was the seismic event, obviously. And I suppose at that point, Dave Dexter was like, well, I guess we have to put this stuff out, huh?
Oh, yeah. And he was, you know, he was, in, rather than being fired, he was in charge of programming those albums. And I think overall, he did a pretty good job on it. You know, that's the crazy thing about it. And but, you know, you talk about all the people who were influenced. I mean, obviously, you know, would Bruce Springsteen have become a musician? I don't know. You know, John Fogerty, you know, wrote that song. I saw it on TV where he talks about, you know, the Beatles. I mean, so many people were influenced. And is a line that I use, and I hesitate to say I made it up, but I haven't heard someone else say it, but I'm sure subconsciously I must have. And that is that there are two kinds of musicians today. Those influenced by the Beatles and liars.
Yeah, I'd like to think that's still true. I don't know. But for me, it's certainly true. And it's funny because Meet the Beatles comes out. And when you look at the, you know, all the hype stuff on the cover, it's like the first album by England's phenomenal pop combo. So clearly all that other stuff, you know, introducing the Beatles and all that didn't really exist. This is the first
record. No. That was
record. And it's called Meet the Beatles. Like, it's like, this is your real introduction to this band. And then the Beatles' second album is like, this is their second album.
Yeah, but Capitol had no idea VJ was coming out with Beatle records. Capitol was told by EMI that we terminated our contract with VJ. You don't have to worry about VJ putting out Beatle records. So they were shocked when, you know, Please Please Me, Backward From Me to You comes out as a new single on VJ, and this album introducing the Beatles starts showing up at stores. So Capitol sues VJ, VJ sues Capitol. The short story is Capitol have better lawyers.
Last night I said these words to my
Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great offerings include the classic Anti-Hero IPA, the non-alcoholic sparkling hop water Super Zero, and the premium lager Cold Time. No matter the weather, Cold Time hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. So, and I saw somewhere that your first two albums were the Coasters' Greatest Hits and Meet the Beatles.
Yeah, love the Coasters.
Which do you listen to more, Meet the Beatles or With the Beatles?
Meet the Beatles.
I got that one before I got With the Beatles. It's all original Beatles songs, yep. except for Till There Was You.
Which was funny, a song that your mom and dad could enjoy.
Right. It's funny that that's the one that he pulled out of all of those, you know, covers, yep. As opposed to like Money or something like that that ended up on the Beatles' second album that actually rocked. Yeah. And then the second album is like all those covers that he left off of the first album. And also somehow made that decision to go from 12 songs to 11 songs. Like, why couldn't he just put, I mean, the British one said 14. Why couldn't he put 12 on the American ones?
Like, you have to understand, you know, first of all, this is the record business. So keep that in mind. In England, royalties on albums were done on a per disc basis. What I mean by that is, if an album had 14 songs on it or 10 songs on it, you paid the same royalty.
In England.
The publishers got their pro rata share. The U.S. was different. In the U.S., it was a mechanical license for every song. And the mechanical license at the song was 2 cents. And you're going, my God, you mean over 4 cents capital for 12 songs rather than 14? Well, okay, 4 cents. What if it sold 1 million copies? Well, that's $40,000. What's $40,000? That's not a lot of money, right? Wrong. $40,000 in those days is over $250,000 today, if not more. So my point is, it was, you know, financial considerations why U.S. albums traditionally had 12 rather than 14. What happened, I'm not sure that it was intentional at first. Dexter's programming the album. He says, okay, we got the 5 tracks from the Beatles' second album. Good start. We also have She Loves You and I'll Get You. All right, now we're up to 7. And then we've got that B-side of Can't Buy Me Love, You Can't Do That. That gets me up to 8. And then, you know, we've got George Martin sent us From Me to You and Thank You Girl, but VJ put out From Me to You as the B-side to Please Please Me. But Thank You Girl, that hadn't been out. Dexter doesn't know Thank You Girl came out in 63. And it also was going to be the flip side of Do You Want to Know a Secret on VJ. But anyway, they get that song. And, you know, EMI, what you got? Oh, we got 2 songs that were recorded for A Hard Day's Night that won't be in the film. You want them? Yeah, send them to us. What a coup that is. I Call Your Name and Long Tall Sally. Now he's got 11 songs. Yep, that's enough. Kids won't know the difference and we'll save some money. Done. That's probably what happened. And the beauty of it all is, Capitol gets a couple of months exclusive on what I consider to be the second greatest rock and roll vocal ever recorded, Paul on Long Tall Sally.
Sure.
The first shout by John Lennon.
And you can't do that as no slouch either. I mean, that came out on this before the Hard Day's Night soundtrack in the UK, right?
Yeah, it was the flip side of Can't Buy Me Love, so it would have been available, yeah.
Okay. So, but yeah, but that's a great song too. I know, it's just, because Meet the Beatles obviously did way better than Capitol expected, and that had 12 songs. They could have just put, you know, one other song on that, because then it sets this pattern where they also repeat it then on Beatles 65 and Something
yes.
New, and you know,
but
not
they
in that
were
order.
They were saving over $250,000 every time they did it.
Right, and making how much they were, you know. A lot.
I understand that, but it was the record business. Come
exactly.
On.
And I understand. I understand. Because okay. Those records are like 25 minutes long. So, you know, it's just kind of funny.
As an American, I will tell you, I love the fact that they had the singles because, you know, you put on the album and that was like, you know, almost 15 minutes of music. You got up, you flipped it over, you put it on again.
Sure.
I didn't have to put on a 45, which was a couple of minutes, you know. So it was less work for me to listen to albums.
Right. I mean, the Beatles' second album, most of it is stuff that's at least as old, if not older, than Meet the Beatles. Mm-hmm. Except for Long Tall Sally and You Can't Do That.
Brand new.
and then you have this crazy thing with the Hard Day's Night soundtrack. I found it fascinating reading your notes about that and about Something New, because they had this agreement where the soundtrack company, you know, they could just United Artists. I was UA. United Artists can put out the album, but not the singles. So yeah. So Capitol can put out the single of A Hard Day's Night and Can't Buy Me Love, for that matter. But UA gets the album, and then you get all that George Martin kind of jazzy versions of Beatles songs on there.
Yeah. I mean, they had the rights to 8 Beatles tracks only. It actually would have been 7. Because I'll Cry Instead, which everyone thought was going to be in the film when George Martin sent the tapes to United Artists and to Capitol, ended up being cut from the film because Richard Lester, the director, felt that it wasn't that great a song and Can't Buy Me Love should be in the film twice. George Martin had thought, why have that song twice? We'll get you a new song. And I think that Lester made the right choice because, look, you know, I'll Cry Instead is a bit of a downer lyrically, and it's just, you know, it's kind of country westernish, and it's just not as great a song as Can't Buy Me Love, which works so well in that film both times.
When I think it was Miramax re-released Hard Day's Night, they stuck I'll Cry Instead at the beginning, the yes. sort of like medley of like, you know, montage of stuff before like the big guitar crash of the opening of the actual opening of the film and the song Hard Day's Night. And I'm just like, you don't want anything before that. Like there shouldn't be.
I agree with you. Yeah,
I'll they Cry Instead done it before a Hard Day's Night. Like, no, the first thing you should hear is that big guitar chord.
It was. I mean, you know, it's the, you know, the world's most famous chord. And, you know, it thanks to Randy Bachman and Giles Martin and others, we finally know what it is. And, you know, it's like George Martin said, we needed something to open up the single, the album, and the film. And it does right. all three spectacularly.
So, and then you have Capitol coming in and they're like, here's something new, a bunch of songs that were just on the soundtrack. Plus, you know, some other stuff we cobbled together that were on the British Hard Day's Night. And then we're going to throw in the German version of I Want to Hold Your Hand, because why not? And then there's your 11 songs and 25 minutes of music.
And the album sold well. It was number two. It never got to number one because the Hard Day's Night soundtrack was firmly, you know, installed at number one.
So tell me about the versions of these compared to like the British versions. I mean, there's a sense that, and some of them are obvious, like, you know, all the echo and reverb put on I Feel Fine, you know, Dave Dexter, again, trying to juice the stuff for the American audience. How much different are a lot of these versions to the British counterpoints? Like, what are the ones that you notice the most?
Well, I think one of the things, bear in mind, on this box set that just came out, these are the mono records. And the reason that the mono records were in the box set is that that was the way that 90% or more, really, of Americans
right.
listened to the Beatles. In the U.S., mono records were a dollar cheaper than stereo records. And I remember my mother saying, you don't have a stereo record player. Why would you want to pay a dollar more? You know, okay, fine. You know, thanks, Mom. I'll save money. She was right. And, you know, that's how it was. So the monos, for the most part, have less reverb. They're really pretty much flat.
Right.
Thank You Girl has reverb, but that's because it's a mix down of the stereo mix that George Martin did for Capitol, which has a bit of reverb in it. The one that you mentioned, I Feel Fine, particularly on the stereo album, is horrendous. First of all, Dave Dexter made a special mix for Capitol of I Feel Fine mono, which had extra echo in it because he knew Capitol would add echo. So what does Dexter do? He adds echo. It's sort of like the old joke that I tell that when I was in college, I went to a party and there was a pitcher of orange juice and a fifth of vodka next to it. So I poured some orange juice into the glass and then I added some vodka to it to make a screwdriver. What I didn't realize was that pitcher of orange juice was a pitcher of screwdrivers already.
Oh, there you go.
So I had extra vodka. And that's why
that's what I Feel Fine is like.
Yeah, extra vodka or extra reverb. And so I think it's a great analogy. So you have that situation. The thing that's really strange is, although the Beatles' second album is really flat in the U.S. in mono, the stereo version, particularly on those five songs from With the Beatles, is full of added echo. And I remember in 1968, when I replaced my album of the Beatles' second album and went to buy it again, only stereo was available. And I put that on the turntable, and it was like I was listening to a different album. It sounded so different. And I hope at some point in time that they do make the Beatles' second album in stereo available, because it is so different and unique than anything that anyone's really heard. That echo on Roll Over Beethoven is just incredible.
Right. So, for instance, And I Love Her, the version that's on the Hard Day's Night soundtrack and on Something New, they're both the same version on this box. And it's the one where his vocal is not double tracked. It's just single tracked, yes. except for when he sings And I Love Her, but that's everything correct. Else. And whereas the British one and maybe the stereo too, he's double tracked the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, on the UA one, the UA stereo is an abomination. They rushed this album out. And, you know, Capitol was expecting it to come out when the film came out in mid-August. And UA knew Capitol was going to release some stuff around the same time. They wanted to get the jump on Capitol. They rushed that album out in late June. And so because they didn't have stereo recordings, they did fake stereo. But not only did they do fake stereo the way that Capitol did, with, you know, you tweak the treble in one channel and boost the bass in the other, they also did some crossfading and weird stuff and by lowering the volume in one channel. So it does some really, really strange stuff. It's a very strange listening experience. Unfortunately, you don't have to suffer through that because the mono album sounds pretty darn good.
Right. Well, and it was interesting to me reading in your notes again that most of Meet the Beatles, much of the Beatles' second album, and most of early Beatles, the mono mixes are actually fold downs of the stereo mixes, even though mono would have been the predominant format at the time.
Yeah, the Capitol engineers, for some reason, thought you got a fuller sound if you took stereo and took the two tracks and collapsed them down to mono. Don't know if that's true or not, but at least when I talked to one of the engineers who was around at the time, he said, yeah, we did that a lot. We just, felt it was better that way.
Have you done a lot of A-B comparisons between these versions and the British, mono box that came out in 2014?
I've done it over the years with CDs and, A-B-ing them. And, I think the U.S. mono albums, I think they sound great and hold up really well. So is it what the Beatles intended? No. Is it really good? Yes.
Well, there's definitely, again, and this is the part of the whole appeal of this box is it's 1964. Now, yeah. Early Beatles is stretching it a bit because that stuff is mostly 63 and it came out in 65. But the point being that this is like a really compressed period of time with all this exciting music coming out. Boom, 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 boom. It's incredible. I mean, Hard Day's Night, whichever version you listen to, is like one of the greatest albums of all time. And that's, the third record they put out within not that long of a period of time. But yeah, I think the American ones, you kind of, because it's amped up a little bit more, it's a little more about the excitement and, kids turning up the volume and rocking out. Whereas the British one is maybe a little more full sounding, but it's not as singles oriented in the first place. I mean, those records aren't about the hits. The hits were taken off those records.
I mean, it's an amazing thing when you think about how productive the Beatles were if you were living in the UK. If you were living in the US, it was like that on steroids. Every time you turned around, Capitol or VJ was putting out another single and the albums kept coming. And George Martin was, thought, well, Capitol is telling us, they need singles all the time. And the current book I'm working on is called Beatles for Sale to Help and covers those two British albums in the U.S. and what happened with Capitol. And when one of the interviews, George Martin is saying, we're going to have the album out and the single, he says, and Capitol has to have another single. So they'll probably pull something from the album as a single later on. And of course, Capitol did. They pulled 8 days a week from the Beatles, for sale album to be a single.
Right.
Because Capitol wanted a single out every month or two.
Because I'd experienced Beatles for Sale, which is a pretty weird record anyway. Beatles 65 is, I'm not as familiar with that as an album. And basically side one is Beatles for Sale side one minus the last song, which is Kansas City, Hey, Hey, Hey. And then side two is just your hodgepodge of, all right, here's your singles. Here's I Feel Fine with the double screwdriver and She's a Woman. And, then they go back to everybody's trying to be my baby at the end and Honey Don't at the beginning.
That's crazy stuff. And when you mention Kansas City, there's a lot of misconception about that particular track. It's not a medley. What it is, it's the Beatles doing Little Richard's version of Kansas City,
right?
Which was re-released a couple years after it came out because Wilbert Harrison was running up the charts with his version of Kansas City. And after Little Richard's recorded that, Little Richard's did a song called Hey, 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 Hey. And so that's why people thought it was a medley, but it's really, really not. In his song is Going to Birmingham, which is kind of a ripoff of Kansas City. So, it's a very convoluted way you get to it. But the bottom line is, it is a great, great arrangement by Little Richard, and the Beatles do it justice, as always.
Well, if you look at that sort of four corners theory of, start and end your each side with like a banger, right?
Spoilers,
Kansas City fits that. Kansas City fits that much better than Mr. Moonlight. I'll just say that.
Oh, absolutely, no doubt about that.
Is there going to be another, box to follow this of like 1965, or are they going to go right to like the Rubber Soul box?
honestly do not know. I'm not privy to the schedule at this time. So I don't know. I'm not being coy. I really don't know what will be released next year.
Because if you're going to do 65, you would have Beatles 6, Help. I think Rubber Soul's the one that, even though it's two songs shorter, at least it's 12 instead of 11 songs, you can make the case for the American Rubber Soul over the British Rubber Soul, even though, I mean, they're great songs on both, and the British one's longer, but the starting those sides with I've Just Seen a Face and It's Only Love, they really fit.
I'm going to give you another liquor analogy.
Okay, good.
People are going to think I'm a drunk. I'm not. I have a, you know, glass.
You are in New Orleans, so you're going to, that's,
yeah,
it comes natural.
It would be all right. I understand. Or if I were British, it would be okay too, right? But anyway, the deal is this. People ask me, which album is better, the U.S. or the U.K. Rubber Soul? And what I tell them is, it's really an unfair question. It's like asking someone to compare a really great red wine with a really great white wine. They both have their own subtleties. I think both of them are brilliant in their own way. I enjoy listening to both of them. It's that
simple. I do too. I agree. And the British Rubber Soul is longer, and it starts off with a rocker, and it's...
But I love what you say about I've Just Seen a Face being buried on side two. It really is. That guitar grabs you. It is a perfect opening for an album.
And that's how I experienced it first, so...
Well, you know, why did that happen? Now, we could do a whole show on Rubber Soul. The short story is very simple. Capitol for Help had the rights to put out a soundtrack album. That's a whole nother story, a whole nother time. Whole nother show. But anyway, Capitol had, after they put out a true soundtrack album for Help, they had already put three of the songs from the side two of the UK Help album, which had film on one side, non-film on the other. And they had four songs that had not been put out yet. They put out Yesterday and Act Naturally as a single. So they had two songs in their inventory that they wanted to get out on the next Beatles album. So boom, there they go. And they used each of those songs to open the two sides. It works out great because those two songs were recorded during the latter part of the sessions. And they have that same folk rock sound that many of the tracks on Rubber Soul have. And they fit so perfectly.
Right. And again, the time is so compressed going from one, you know, it's not like they're a year older. When they do the next record, they're just like a month old or whatever. I mean, even later on, it's like I sort of remind people that like the Let It Be session started, what, like 2-3 months after they finished making the White Album. I mean, it's like it's boom, boom, all this time. But especially, you know, 64, 65.
I mean, groups, remember, we had a time in the 90s where groups would take 3 or 4 years between records. You know, the Beatles were putting out two albums a year.
Oh, I wrote something for the Tribune, Chicago Tribune. You know, it must have been about 10 years ago or more, maybe, when Adele was like still working on her third album. And I basically said, as much time will have passed between Adele's first and third albums as the Beatles going to Hamburg and finishing their entire catalog. And actually my sort of semi-serious point on that story was that back then, you know, so many of the greatest albums ever made came out less than a year after the predecessor, you know, and you'd look at where you're talking about Dylan, the Stones, I mean, any of these bands, you know, it was like just these things were one thing after another. And yeah. You know, even, you know, bands I loved later, like Elvis Costello and the Attractions or Talking Heads or REM, you know, it was like boom, boom, boom. But in the 60s, it was insanely boom, boom, boom. And they just kept rising to that level.
They did. And the thing about it too was there's more spontaneity. And music hit a point, and you know, and it's really unfair for me to pick on one group, but I'll pick on Wilson Phillips. Everything sounds so really nice, and it's so well produced, and the vocal harmonies are so beautiful, and it's homogenized. I don't know any other word to use it.
Right.
Whereas what the Beatles were doing on those first few albums, they were recording, as we like to say, live in the studio, playing and singing at the same time. If there were mistakes made, so be it. They were exciting, and they weren't overdubbing stuff. And, you know, every now and then, a young band will say, you know, we're going to record like they did in the old days, you know, like the Weaklings do that. And other, many other groups, I'm sure, are doing it, where they go in and they record it live, minimal overdubs. It's so much more exciting.
Sure. You know,
because accidents happen. But a lot of times, Those are great accents. You listen to I'll Get You. Yes, we know in the third verse, John and Paul are singing different lyrics. So what? It sounds great.
Right. Well, and I used to always love, you know, like when I'd hear If I Fell, I'd be like, is this the one where Paul's voice cracks? Because some of them he does and some of them he doesn't. And I think it's like maybe the stereo he does that the mono ones we just have on this one, they cut out the voice cracking. But I love that his voice cracks on some of them.
I mean, you know, music back in those days, George Martin's thing was, we don't need to get it perfect. We need to get it exciting. And often it was perfect. And often it wasn't. I mean, John hated double tracking. And there are times when toward the end of the song, you know, he wouldn't really be double tracking. You'd hear like two different distinct John Lennon voices singing different things in different places. And it's brilliant. Sounds great.
Which is ironic because he really liked double tracking as a solo artist.
He didn't like double. What he liked was artificial double tracking when he didn't have to sing it twice. And Ken Townsend came up with that. And that, you know, that really was a big deal with him because John was lazy, didn't like double tracking. And Ken Townsend came up with, you know, just sing it one time, John, and then we'll run it the second time slightly out of sync and it'll sound like twice.
So you're obviously encyclopedic on so much of this stuff. What were the revelations you had working on this project? Because you had to dive deep into it. What did you find new that you just didn't realize before?
Honestly, not much. You know, I really have known this stuff well for a long time. But I think in listening to the new albums, there were some subtleties that, you know, sounded much clearer than before. And one of the little silly things that I noticed was at the beginning of side one of Something New, I'll Cry Instead, for a millisecond, there's an extraneous noise. And I asked Kevin Reeves, who was doing the mastering, I said, Kevin, are you hearing that? And he emailed back, now that you mention it, I'm hearing it. And I said, well, what do you think it is? And I think he and I both concluded, we thought it was the sound of John's acoustic guitar being just, you know, like John accidentally hitting it or something and it being picked up right before they begin the take of the song. And on some of the single, on the single and other things, it's chopped off. But for whatever reason, when that tape was sent to Capitol, it was not chopped off. In Capitol, when they put out the Something New album, didn't chop it off. So if you listen carefully, it's just a millisecond. You have this extraneous noise, and Kevin Reeves and I both think it's John's acoustic guitar.
And it's not on the Hard Day's Night version?
No, it's not on the United Artists album.
Oh, interesting.
Or the Capitol single. It's only on the mono Something New. Only right. Place.
Well, and then Something New and the United Artists album is like the 2 minute and 3 second version or whatever. And then the British one, it's like a minute 40 because they don't repeat the first verse.
Yeah, well, what happened is, this is an interesting little story if we have time for it. George Martin said, look, you know, we should not have Can't Buy Me Love in the film twice. And so John had this new song, I'll Cry Instead, which he liked. And he said, but it's too short for the film. So he had the Beatles record it in two sections. And in section one, you know, that's done. And then when they did section two, he had John toward the beginning of it re-sing the first verse. So it's not an edit where you hear the same first verse twice. It's a totally different first verse being sung by John. And that in this book I have called The Beatles, A Hard Day's Night and More, I explain how that works. And so because of it, you hear John sing the first verse twice, but if you listen carefully, he's singing a totally different time.
Interesting.
And that makes the song longer because he edits it that way. But George Martin also thought, well, you know, maybe for the studio album, we won't use that longer edit. And so the same day he made that long edit for the film, he did a shorter edit for the studio album. So, you know, people think he did them at different times. He didn't. He did those edits at the same time.
Right. So the British got the minute 40 version and the Americans got the 203 or whatever it is.
Except the Capitol Stereo Something New has the shorter version because George Martin sent him that tape. But the United Artists mono and stereo, because remember, the stereo is a fake stereo.
Right.
And the mono Something New have the longer version of I'll Cry Instead. Listen carefully when he's singing that first verse. It's not an edit of that repeating it. He is singing it totally different.
Interesting. By the way, speaking of things being repeated, did you notice on the, I have this right here, the Beatles 65, has it been pointed out to you that they repeated two paragraphs?
Yes, it's been pointed out to me. I will tell you
All right.
that Beatle fans catch everything.
Yeah, I'm sure. And, I didn't think I'd be the first one to point that out, but I was just curious.
When I did my liner notes, I was very happy that they were, you know, there's some names on the back of that booklet, like Aaron Brenner and Guy Hayden and Mike Heatley, and those guys proofed my liner notes. And I was glad they did, because I wanted those extra, you know, pairs of eyes. And there were a few minor things that, you know, we tweaked after discussion. Nothing censored or anything like that. And anyway, what I'm sure happened is when that particular booklet was being laid out, a layout error occurred. But, you know, people like, oh, this is terrible. The two paragraphs were repeated. Hey, don't read them. You've already read them. Get over it. You know,
I was reading them going, this sounds familiar. And I'm like, wait a minute.
Yeah, right, it's the exact here. Same thing.
I took it as like the first verse of, you know, I'll Cry Instead being, you know, the American, you know, it's the American right. album. So we get the extra
right. So only
repetition.
The American version has. Yeah, right. Yeah, we should have. I should have jokingly said we did it to see if anyone would notice. But it's a layout error. It's no big deal. You know, much worse would have been leaving out two paragraphs for Meet the Beatles. If you're going to make a mistake, repeating two paragraphs is a lot better than leaving something out. And it's a lot better than people saying, you know, Bruce, you made a really bad factual error here. So, you know, this is just a simple layout error. Get over it, folks.
I feel like it's actually a good sign, because, like, as a writer, I would really appreciate, you know, anyone getting there means they've read the entire, yes. you know, the entire set of liner notes, both sides of the double truck, because you have to get to the end of it to get to that repeated thing. So it's a good sign. If a lot of people are pointing that out, that means people are reading what you wrote, and that's what you care about most.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I felt very honored to have been asked to do this. But, you know, it's things move quickly in the Beatles world, because sometimes decisions take longer to make than the execution period. And so, you know, I was in London over the summer and, you know, meeting with Universal on this project. And it's like, okay, well, you know, seven essays. Okay, sure. How soon do you need them? As soon as you can get us to us. Okay, fine. You know, and boom, done. Okay. Knock them out relatively quickly. And it was a lot of fun doing those, because I felt that I wanted to use it, not to write about the music, because it's been done so often, but to write about why Capitol did what they did.
Sure.
You know, and I thought that was important that people understand that.
You're telling the Beatles story. And then it includes the Beatles story.
Yes.
Which is...
I
have to say, I felt like your liner notes on that, because you basically sort of summarize it. It's almost like, look, I'm going to tell you what's in there so you don't really have to listen to it. I don't know if the Universal people want me to say that, but it's because I put that back on, and I actually have it from way back when, and the part where they're crying about touching Paul and stuff cracks me up. But, you know,
it's a timepiece. I'm glad it was included. Everyone should listen to it at least one time, and maybe more when you're just feeling in a goofy mood, you know, listen to it, have fun with it. But it's clearly a timepiece, no doubt.
Sure.
About it.
Sure. It does make me regretful that they didn't just put out the August 64 Beatles at the Hollywood Bowl, which I guess six of those ended up on the 70s version of that record. And then seven of those tracks were from the 65 performances.
And then, of course, on the gray market, you can find it. So,
yeah. So that'll be in the next box. That could have been in the box too, right? They could have put on, they could have
that
done.
That would have been really cool if they had said, let's put out the album Capitol wanted to put out. Yeah. But, you know, sometimes things are really cool. They're a great idea. But when you got to get everyone to sign off on it.
I was going to say, I imagine it's hard to get everyone. If you couldn't get everyone to agree on it at the time, I could imagine it would be hard to get everyone to agree on it now. Well, this is great. Thanks. I really enjoyed talking with you. I've really enjoyed the box as well. And
thank you.
You know, you elevated it with all of your notes and everything. I love again, like being able to open it up and read along as I'm listening to these punchy little records.
I thought it was a brilliant idea that they came up with, because, you know, look, I love a hardcover book, but as you say, you know, you get the hardcover book and then all of a sudden, you know, you're going and flipping and going back and forth in this. In different albums. And in this, they realize that this is going to be marketed as separate albums and not just in the box.
Right.
And someone came up with the brilliant idea, hey, let's just do these little inserts. You know, we don't need to write about the music. that's been written about before. Let's write about the albums. I thought it was a brilliant idea that, you know, someone or a team of people came up with, and I was honored to be the one to execute it.
So when someone buys the separate Meet the Beatles, they're getting all this, these same inserts that
you get
in the box. So yes. You have this like sort of facsimile of the tape look like. You open it up, there are all your notes, and then there's stuff on the back. And then there's also this facsimile of what the actual record sleeve would have been with all of the jazz records and stuff that would have been promoted at that time. And then you have a nice actual inner sleeve that's not going to scratch up the record. So it's nicely done.
Yeah, thank you. I think with any Beatles project, you could say, you know, I wouldn't have done exactly that. All right. But what you really should say is review what was actually done and grade it for what it is and not for what you or someone else would have done. And when you do that, I can't think of a single project that Apple has put out that I would say, oh, this is a B or a C. Everything is high quality and a lot of thought is put into it. And the idea is the same thing that the Beatles were doing, give people good value for their money. You know, they're paying good money for this, give them something of good value.
And it's interesting to me also that your audiophiles, which is sort of an ever-growing community now, it seems, the mono ones are really the records for them because they have like the all analog path, and you know, it gets into, you know, the really technical stuff of like, you know, what this was cut on and what equipment it went through and the tubes and everything else. But like the mono stuff, even these early Beatle records have this sort of pure analog path that the stereo stuff has not, because the stereo stuff has been sort of, you know, tinkered with a little more, and that stuff sounds great too, but it's not that same all analog experience that the mono box and this have, the 2014 mono box and the US mono box have.
Yeah, Kevin Reeve did a great job on it, cutting the lacquers in Nashville. And Kevin and I exchanged emails about different things. He was really, you know, wanted to know all the details. And I sent him my 1964 first pressings of all the albums, which he used as references. There's a video of him, I think, holding up a copy of Meet the Beatles. That's my mono copy of Meet the Beatles.
Wow.
And by having those references, that shows you the kind of effort and detail that Kevin put into this, which was typical. Everyone associated with this project put in the effort to make this the best it could be.
And it shows an amount of trust for you to give up all those precious early mono copies of your records too.
Well, you know, engineers are very careful about things.
Yeah.
So
you must keep them in pretty good shape too.
Oh yes. These are in, you know, pristine condition.
Nice. So, and then coming up, you have this Beatles for Sale Help book coming up.
Yes. I started when Pepper hit its 50th anniversary. I did a book called The Beatles and Sgt. Pepper, A Fan's Perspective. And that I didn't know it was going to be a whole series of books. And so I do a separate book on each album or group of albums, if group of albums makes more sense for it. So in other words, you know, Abbey Road's going to have its own, Let It Be's going to have its own, but Magical Mystery Tour and Yellow Submarine go together. Could you write a whole book on Rubber Soul Revolver? Yes, but because in the U.S., the way things were done with Yesterday and Today in the middle, I did a book called Rubber Soul Revolver. I did Please, Please Me to With the Beatles. I did A Hard Day's Night on its own. And the last book in the series will be Beatles for Sale to Help. And it will have the British albums, you know, hence the title, but also Beatles 65, Beatles 6, and the Capitol soundtrack album, and also the U.S. singles. All the books have their stuff on the records, and they also have what I call fan recollections, where just people who have written into me about their experiences of hearing these records at the first time or going to the films. For in Hard Day's Night, the lead fan recollection was from Patty Boyd, where she told how she met George on the set of A Hard Day's Night.
Nice.
Other ones are from people going to the film and hearing the screaming. And finally, the last sections talk about how the covers were done and the packaging done, and how each song was written and recorded in great detail, but not so much detail that you need to be a music major to follow it, because I'm not a music major.
Right. That sounds great. I can't wait to read it. Thank you so much again. And what do you think the chances are that Apple will ever re-release Yesterday and Today with the original cover?
If you were going to do a box, it would be kind of fun to do that. And you could also do it probably where you could literally have kind of a paste over.
The peel over, trunk peel cover, off, yeah.
And then you could take it off and have it. I think it'd be fun if they do it. I certainly would love to be involved with it. It's great fun.
Congrats on a great job on this. And thanks so much for talking. It was really fun.
Great to do so. I'm glad we got together.
That's it for episode 161 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Bruce Spicer for sharing his enthusiasm and deep knowledge as we dug into the Beatles' U.S. albums in mono and the history surrounding it. This new all-analog, hot-sounding 7-album vinyl box from Capitol and AppleCore is widely available. You also can buy each album separately, aside from the Beatles story. Spicer's extensive notes come inside each album in either configuration. Spicer also has a fab website with a fab URL, beatle.net. How'd he get that? You can order his Beatles books there, read articles, and learn more about him. Keep an eye out for his last book in his Beatles album series, the upcoming Beatles for Sale to Help. Caropop is produced by Chris Swake, who's been working like a dog. It would please us if you wanted to support us as the year comes to a close. Go to caropop.com and you can give $24 or whatever you'd like. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caropop on Blue Sky, Instagram, and Twitter X at Caropopcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week and next year for another Caropop conversation. Happy holidays, everybody, and we'll see you in 2025. Thanks.